the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for March the 10th, 2019, the second Sunday of March and the first Sunday of Daylight Savings Time. Ugh. Welcome to our
7:08. 7:08. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Mr. Schwann. How are you?
Well, okay.
Yeah,
I have to get adjusted to this myself.
We're going to be doing a lot of that this morning.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I love doing this show, and I have a lot of fun doing it, and I hope you all realize that, but this is the worst Sunday of doing the show. I think the only time I was ever late for this show was a daylight savings time switch on Sunday morning.
I remember that day.
Yeah, boy, did I
remember that.
Frantically
day.
Got here. I was 18 minutes late, and you know, thankfully Steve Dale was here. Although I think he had dogs picking presidential candidates or something. It was, but yeah, it's and. You know, I did my best to prepare for everything. I went to bed early, made sure all the clocks were set right, and, you know, no problems today, except I could not sleep because I was afraid of oversleeping. I don't know about you, Dave.
But yeah, I think that was pretty much it. I've had some dental surgery Friday.
Oh.
And was kind of dealing, not anything real bad here, but, you know, just acclimating with that and thinking about...
You got that kind of hollow place in your mouth where that tongue
right,
hangs,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Doesn't the tongue always, it finds that
is,
little
it
space.
It is strange. It is strange, isn't it? Yes, and bit down on that part of the mouth earlier this morning.
Oh, good.
But, you know, I was thinking about that, thinking about not oversleeping, and thinking about the remote that we'll be on later this morning.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll be over at the American Lung Association.
Stair Climb at Presidential Towers.
Andy and I will be leaving there leaving here in about an hour.
Yeah, quarter. And I saw you kind of doing some of your stretching exercises, Andy. And
yes, breathing exercises, too.
Thank goodness there's enough room in the sports booth for you to, you know, do a full complement of...
Sorry about the dents in the wall.
You open the door so you can do arm stretches.
Yeah, that does do the trick.
Well, I would have loved to have taken part in this. You know me, Mr. Athletics, but I have a doctor's note that because of the shoulder, I shouldn't take part. I'm excused.
Mm-hmm.
But good news on the shoulder front. I'm out of the sling and it's moving around and. Finally, had the doctor last week show me an X-ray of exactly what he did, and it's kind of pretty terrifying when you look at it.
You sent me the picture,
yes,
and it does look like a bionic bionic arm. So we can call you the bionic man now, the
not
bionic
quite
reporter,
not yeah, the bionic reporter, yeah, instead of a bot, right?
Yeah, instead of a bot,
yes.
Right.
No, I mean, and it's healing well. I am sleeping for better than I've slept since, you know, before I fractured it. Except I just couldn't sleep last night. And so in honor of the terror of moving the clocks ahead 1 hour, I decided to wear my Svengoolie hoodie from my good friend Brian Bernadoni. So with all due respect to Svengoolie, that's an hour that's gone. Now, you can't say this is an hour that you'll never get back. You know,
sure.
Unlike covering some political events and certainly, Andy, some sports events,
mm-hmm.
You know, we'll get the hour back. It's just when we get it back, we're heading into winter.
Yeah, we don't want it then.
No. I just don't know what... there's a lot of talk about getting rid of it.
And they should.
My friend in Arizona says that they leave their clocks alone. They don't set them forward. They don't set them back. They just leave them as is. So it's 6:12 in the morning in Phoenix right now, and it will be 6:12 in the morning come fall.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of debate. They say it upsets sleeping patterns.
Yes, and there have been statistics that say there are more heart attacks, people coming into emergency rooms with more heart attacks at and around this time.
Productivity.
No one
problems.
Wants to, you know, go there.
Yeah, I. Whatever reason, it's, you know.
Let's just say it's 6:12 now.
No, it's 7:12. Don't do that. It's 7:12.
It is 7:12. Yes.
Come on, we've got to be responsible.
We do.
Here. Well, sort of, but we got you know, a busy week ahead. We got St. Patrick's Day next weekend.
There were a bunch of suburban parades today.
I know. I thought Elmhurst was yesterday. I'm not sure, but a whole bunch of parades, and then of course the big parade next Saturday downtown, and then
South Side Parade,
and of course then we have St. Patrick's Day Sunday. Our next show will be on St. Patrick's Day. So Engineer Bob has already got the slow cooker going with the corned beef, so we'll be in good stead. We'll be having Reuben sandwiches for breakfast next
and
Sunday.
For one day only, all our names begin with O.
O'Schwan?
O'Schwan, O'Pearson, and O'Mazur, and O'Ferguson.
O'Schwan.
I've heard it said that way a number of times.
Yeah, I bet. And exactly that kind of cadence, too. O'Schwan. So I went to bed early. I did not make it through past the first period of the Blackhawks game. I wished I'd been able to see the whole game, but I saw all the scoring I needed
in that
first period, which is totally surprising for this team.
Yeah, didn't take a first period off yesterday. And I'll tell you what, the fourth line was doing wonders. So it was Kruger, Kampf, and Kunitz. And Kunitz with a dynamite pass to Kampf for that first goal. And then
that passing was just...
It was crazy, wasn't it?
It was, and through the skates of the defenseman for the return for the goal.
Tic-tac goal.
Yeah, that... Because I was getting worried a little bit, even though they had scored the first goal, and then 75 seconds later, Dallas ties it up. But I was still seeing kind of a little bit of laziness in that defensive end.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to see them go ahead 2-1 after the first period. But then the next two periods, you know, I just can only imagine how that could be scoreless, because this is not the way the Blackhawks have played for a long time.
No. And, you know, they had the benefit, and, you know, part of it is a little skewed, but we're choosing to take the high road here and the good road. Dallas does not score goals. I mean, they're a team that doesn't score a lot. They're averaging under 3 goals a game, but they're also giving up under 3 goals a game. So that's how they've been winning with goaltending, basically. But Corey Crawford was dynamite, and you know, he didn't face too many shots. He
only five shots in the third period.
5
shots in the third period, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, because Dallas is like a havoc team.
Yeah.
They try to disrupt in between the blue lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then see if they can take advantage to go offensively. Like I said, that first period, I thought we were way, once again, in our own zone too much. But, you know, who knows? 7 points away, 14 games to play, a big win against, you know, a team that's in playoff spot.
Yeah.
We just got to keep it going.
Yeah, and, you know, Monday night becomes another must-win. They're taking on the Coyotes. Coyotes are only 3 points out of that final playoff spot as play begins today. So I'm not sure what they'll obviously be tomorrow when that game starts. But, you know, it's another team in front of you. That, you know, everybody says, okay, there's 7 points out, but there's a couple of teams, maybe 3
teams.
Yeah,
that's what everybody forgets. It's not like, a normal standings.
Yeah.
It's everybody's rolling here.
Yeah, they were tied with Edmonton yesterday. I believe it was... for 6th or 7th. Well, actually, it couldn't have been that, because they're the third team that was out of the playoffs. So
right.
Right there at that cut line, so to speak. But, you know, if they continue to play, they're playing with a sense of urgency here, which is really good to see, obviously, because every game is almost as if it's a playoff game.
Well, yeah, and it's every game's a must win. I'm sorry. It has to be that way, and that's got to be the attitude. And you know, it's just kind of like, I wonder where this team was that played last night.
Yeah. All year.
Yeah. Knowing the priority you have to place on defense. And, you know, this isn't about, the fact that Corey Crawford, you know, is now playing again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the goalies, it's the defense. And
yeah, I think people forget that. I think people blame the goaltenders a lot for things that happen, but, you know, 9 times out of 10, and maybe 8 times out of 10, it's because of a defensive breakdown right in front of them. And that's generally how that goes. And it's really unknown to the, you know, to the casual fan, where they think they see 4 or 5 goals and they think, oh, the goalie had a bad night. Well, not necessarily, because they're point blank chances.
Well, I remember over at Tribune Tower, the you know, in the lobby, it was inscribed with all of the those great, you know, First Amendment and freedom of the press statements, and then they opened Howells and Hood's restaurant, and they had kind of playing off that theme, they had various quotes, and when he walked into Howells and Hood's in the lobby, they had the great Jacques Plante quote, which I'm paraphrasing, which was, you think you got a lousy job, how would you like to be playing in front of 18,000 people and every time you make a mistake a flashing red light goes on and they're all yelling at you? that's pretty
accurate.
that's real work.
That's right on
there. Oh, well, I know you guys will do a great job over at Presidential Towers, and you know, my money's riding on Dave Schwann, actually.
Yeah,
to
wish
finish
me,
first.
I walk across the hall.
Pardon?
That's as far as I get. I walk across the hall.
No, yeah. Well, you had to take the headphones off before, you know, you can't.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way.
You don't
want to
have them yank. that hurts. You could.
Yeah.
That could hurt that loose tooth. That, or maybe that's how you get rid of it, actually. You didn't need the dentist.
The tooth is gone. The tooth is gone. It's the vacancy now that needs to be filled.
How much is the rent for that?
Oh, you don't want to know.
It's a mouthful.
They sure. When I left, they said, we'll see what the insurance says.
Oh,
you know how that goes.
Oh, do I ever. Do I ever. Lately, more than ever. Exactly.
Yeah, I think you do.
Yes, indeed. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Casera is in, fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. Our text line is also 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is changing the clocks here in the studio as we speak. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. It's 7:20 on 7:20 on this Sunday morning. This is the Sunday Spin. . 7:23 on this first Sunday morning of daylight savings time here in Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. Up ahead on the show, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to State Representative Robert Martwick. He's a supporter of the graduated rate income tax that's been proposed by Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, and we'll talk to him about that proposal. After the top of the hour, when Dave and Andy give us another check of the news and sports, we'll speak to Greg Bays. You've heard Greg here before. He's the recently retired head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and he's in charge of a group called Ideas Illinois, and that group is opposed to Pritzker's graduated rate income tax plan. And then after the 8:30 news and sports, we'll speak to Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Schaumburg. The congressman is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, and we'll talk to him about the House Democrats and the new majority in their pursuit of investigations into the Trump administration. That's all coming up. It's time for our spin through national politics, and no shortage again of news coming out of Washington. On Friday, the president's White House communications chief, Bill Shine, the former president of Fox News, resigned. The two apparently weren't getting along. We also had the sentencing of former Trump campaign head Paul Manafort to almost 4 years in prison. But the president said, notably, it didn't involve collusion with Russia.
I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. I think it's been a very, very tough time for him. But if you notice, both his lawyer, a highly respected man, and a very highly respected judge, the judge, said there was no collusion with Russia. This had nothing to do with collusion. There was no collusion. It's a collusion hoax. It's a collusion witch hoax. I don't collude with Russia. So I just want to tell you that his lawyer went out of his way, actually, to make a statement last night. No collusion with Russia. There was absolutely none. The judge, I mean, for whatever reason, I was very honored by it, also made the statement that this had nothing to do with collusion with Russia. So, you know, keep it going. Let's go. Keep the hoax going. Just a hoax. Senator Burr said there's no collusion. You look at Devin Nunes and the House Intelligence Committee. They said there's no collusion. And guess what? There is none.
So I think you know where the president stands when it comes to Russian collusion. Of course, the Mueller investigation still ongoing. And in fact, as far as Paul Manafort, he's also facing sentencing on other crimes. So while there's a lot of concern over the fact that after federal prosecutors in Virginia had recommended a much stiffer sentence and that he only got 4 years, there are another sentencing process going on, one which Manafort could face another 10 years. It'll be interesting to see if that will be running concurrent or on top of the 47th month sentence that Manafort got. We've also got Trump's executive order plan to divert money to build a border wall, which has hit its own wall in the U.S. Senate, with Republicans saying they will join with Democrats to disapprove the order. That slowed Trump's progress. On CNN, former Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich joined with other former GOP congressmen to sign a letter urging Republicans in Congress to disapprove.
Look, it's really important you don't set a precedent so that future presidents just can't go declaring national emergencies. And I think the reason why the Republicans will, in fact, support this resolution is because they'll argue at home that this is really about the Constitution and about the ability to stop a future power grab by somebody who doesn't have their philosophy. And so I think this is one that's relatively easy for them. And if I were to bet money on all this, I don't think that the leadership in the Senate really cared much about this vote. I mean, they didn't scurry around and get all frosted up about stopping this, because I think most of them will be pleased that this precedent of not allowing presidents to just unilaterally do things, because that wasn't the intention of the law.
That's former Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. It's 7:35 Central Daylight Time here in Chicago. This is your Sunday Spin. Before the news, I played a cut of the former Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich, who's talking about why Republicans should oppose the executive order that the president has proposed to redirect money from the Pentagon and defense funds for building the wall. On the Senate floor last week, Illinois senior senator, Democrat Dick Durbin, he gave his rationale for why the Trump executive order should be rejected.
This year, we're facing quite a challenge from the Trump administration. You see, this notion of building a $5.7 billion wall is going to be paid for at the expense of the United States military. It's the military that will end up surrendering projects that are underway, investments in our troops that are underway, so that the president can build this almighty wall of his that was supposed to be paid for by the Mexicans, right? I heard him say that. Oh, only 100 times, but I heard him say it.
That's Illinois Democratic Senior Senator Dick Durbin. We're going to switch gears now, and joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for getting up extra early this morning and joining me here on the Sunday Spin.
What time is it?
Yeah, it is 7:37 Central Daylight Time.
Well, it's always good to be here at any time of the day.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, it kind of an interesting week last week, and I'm not sure I expected it. Was Governor Pritzker laid out his proposal for the actual rates for the graduated rate income tax that he had campaigned on. I mean, and let's be honest, he made no secret about it throughout his campaign from the get-go. that he was supporter of changing the constitutionally mandated flat rate income tax structure in Illinois and replace it with a graduated rate tax, raising the rate depending on income. And when he gave his budget slash state of the state speech, he made it sound like there was going to be a negotiating process. And indeed, he still says there is going to be a negotiating process. I just was kind of surprised to see him have an announcement saying, well, here's the opening ante here. And in their words, 97% of taxpayers will get tax relief from this. And we use the term graduated tax. Supporters call it progressive tax. I mean, in essence, we're talking about something akin to the federal income tax structure.
Right.
You had proposed legislation 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
Kind of taking into account all of the state's liabilities, whatever, and just kind of threw it out there as chum.
That's exactly what
it was.
Which
the Sharks did go after.
Yeah, they did. And I'm glad. So I was asked a question recently about do I regret that I put something out there? And never. I mean, anytime you are having that discussion, you are making people aware of an idea. And this idea is not going to be in any way, shape, or form easy for the administration or the legislature to pass. But the idea that people have talked about it for 2 years gives them an understanding of what we're trying to do and how we're trying to do it. And that, I think that discussion was really worthwhile.
Well, and let's remember, too, to actually do this means changing the Constitution.
Yes.
And that's not a simple process. No. And it takes a 3/5 majority in the House, takes a 3/5 majority in the Senate. Yes, Democrats do have veto-proof majorities in the legislature. And then if it gets that approval, then it goes before voters in the form of a referendum on the ballot. And that would be in November of 2020.
Right.
In essence, the administration says that those making more than $250,000 a year would pay more in this, under this structure. And it would generate $3.4 billion in additional revenue. Now, given that bill that you had 2 years ago, taking into account all of the liabilities, my question is, does it shoot too low? Given the liabilities that the state faces, $3.4 billion, I mean, the hole in the budget for the budget year that starts July 1st is $3.2 billion.
That's correct, yeah.
So this just barely covers that hole. And we had kind of in the Pritzker campaign where the graduated rate income tax was kind of the panacea for everything. We're going to, if you identify a problem, the graduated rate income tax is going to take care of it.
Yes, I'm going to give the governor his due here. I'm going to call it a fair tax because that's what he wants to call
it. Fair tax, progressive tax, and yes. Then we're going to have Greg Bayes on after you, who called it a jobs tax.
Yes, so. Exactly. No. So the fair tax proposal that the governor has put forth is it is very different than mine. But again, this will be part of the legislative process. Does it aim too low? I would say no. I would say that it. Anytime you are raising the money that you need to close our current budget deficit, we've been running a structural budget deficit for decades.
Yes.
And that's why we have $134 billion of unfunded liability in our pension systems, because when you run a deficit, you don't pay into the pensions, you don't pay your bills on time, and you build up debt. So the idea that we could actually, for the first time in decades, close our budget deficit and put the state on a path towards fiscal stability is awesome. The fact that 97% of the taxpayers in Illinois will see tax relief is awesome too. Does it do enough? That I think that's the question that we're going to have when it comes down now, is the part where the legislature will start negotiating. But the important part here is this: laying out, doing the math for something this big requires the governor's office to get involved. This is the point that I made constantly about Governor Rauner, about where he would just sit back and say, well, you guys do the work. And it's like, no, you have all the resources. You have the Office of Management and Budget to help you, this massive staff, to do the math and do the analyses. So I think it's great that he said, here's a starting point. Let's negotiate. Here's a path forward. You know, that when it comes down to it, it's simple, right? He took the path of 97% of Illinois taxpayers receiving relief. You can move those sliders, right? You can raise those rates, have a lower group. Maybe, you know, you can move it to a different income level that sees a modest tax increase to raise more revenue. And then you can use that money to provide more property tax relief than he's given, or more pension debt reduction than he's given. But this is a great starting point, and it really does put us on a path that we've never been on.
Well, and obviously, and I think this was a feeling of many legislators, and even Republicans would agree, not that they're necessarily supportive of a graduated rate tax, but that you got to know the rates before the voters, you know, the rates almost have to be put into law, not in constitutional amendment, but put into law conditional upon a constitutional amendment, because otherwise it just becomes kind of a argument of you can paint the darkest picture you want, well, as opponents do.
Yes, and what I would say about that is this, is that you know, I really give Governor Pritzker a lot of credit because he has said the table is open. Come join me, even if you don't agree with me. Come join me and weigh in on how this should look, which I think is pretty fascinating. To be fair, the Republican Party has been the party of no. 2 years ago, they said, show me a rate structure. And I showed them a rate structure and showed, well, they completely lied about it. The rate structure I adopted was the rate structure of the state of Wisconsin, and it was never meant to be the solution. But they immediately glommed on to the first rate increase and said, I was raising taxes on everyone making more than $17,500. They said it 2 weeks ago, and that's an abject lie. Either that or they don't know how to do math. And what I'm saying is if you're either, if you know the math or you're lying about the math, either way, it's bad for the process, right? We've got to be honest about this if we're going to solve our problems. That rate structure comparatively raised taxes on anyone making more than $67,500. Governor Pritzker's is $250,000. So to come in and say that this somehow or another, that this is going to affect the middle class is just false.
No, but when you proposed it, though, it filled the vacuum that existed, because there wasn't a, you know, there was that concept of a graduated rate income tax.
Right.
But what are the devils in the details? Always, and we always knew it would be.
Yes.
But
yes.
I do want to go back to, is it big enough? Only because, you know, we've been around before when it comes to issues of taxation in the state. And it takes a lot of motivation to get the votes to do a tax increase. And it only comes at certain times, and I'm speaking here as a reporter, not as a proponent or an opponent.
Sure.
But when those times come, you normally shoot big.
Yeah, that goes to
my earlier question about big enough.
Yeah, and I think that's a legitimate question, and again, I think that that's something that we will have to shake out. And again, what I would say is, my fellow members in the legislature are they're far more equipped because of the discussion we had 2 years ago that showed a rate structure and what you could do with it, to figure out where they want to weigh in on, is it enough? Is it too much? You know, and I think that process will begin in earnest, and I think it will be informed. And I'm proud of that, right? That I at least had people talking about it and understanding what's going on with it. Where we go forward on this is going to be fascinating, but like I said, I'm just really excited. I don't have the ultimate answer. I'm just really thrilled that it's moving forward. There's no doubt that this is going to be a heavy lift. I told the governor the very first day we met and talked about this. I was in a Democratic caucus meeting when Governor Quinn came and wanted to make the 5% tax permanent. And we needed 71 votes because we knew the Republicans weren't going to join us in that. We didn't have anywhere near 71 votes. We didn't have 60 votes to pass it as an initiative. So, the idea that just because we have 74 Democrats that we're going to get there is not the case. And the governor has a lot of work to do, so I'm encouraged by his interest.
And I want to ask you more on that, but first we have to take a break. We're speaking with Robert Martwick, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick from Chicago. We're talking about Governor Pritzker's unveiling last week of the tax rate structure that he'd like to see in a graduated rate income tax, something that would require a change in the Constitution, something that the voters would have to ultimately approve if lawmakers put it on the ballot. And right before the break, you kind of got to one of my questions, and this is something that I've been trying to see, is are there 71 votes in the House among the 74-member Democratic majority to put a graduated rate income tax proposal on the ballot?
Well, and I think ultimately there will be. I don't know that you'd want to take that vote right now. But I think a lot of this is sort of the education process. And, you know, there has been a change. I mentioned that 2014 Quinn initiative to make the 5% tax permanent. But even the Democratic caucus is decidedly more informed on this issue, more progressive or liberal when it comes to these issues. And so I think that it will be an easier lift than it was in 2014, but I don't think by any means easy. But that's where, you know, the administration has said that they're going to put a lot of effort into education and explaining this to people. There are people where there are representatives where 99%, even 100% of their district will receive a tax decrease. How do you say that I can fix the problems, ensure that we will fund education, make sure that there are no more devastating cuts like there were under the Rauner administration, and get all my constituents a tax cut, but I'm not going to vote for that? And I think that's where the education process will come in.
I think, you know, obviously property taxes being the big issue that they are, an ever-growing issue. When it comes to property tax relief, this isn't really much here in this.
You know, it is. It's
expanding the tax credit by one percentage point.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's definitely some relief. Again, you know, the
$5 a month.
Yeah, it's. There's no doubt. It's. It is not going to cut everyone's property tax bills in half. But again, the idea is that we took decades to get into this situation. Decades of Illinois being irresponsible with its finances, not financing projects that it should be financing, not properly financing education, and allowing, really, I mean, when you look at high property taxes, it is the fault of Springfield that property taxes are so high. And again, I think it's going to take a while to turn this ship. Nothing is going to get solved tomorrow. But the idea that he started with closing the structural deficit and then beginning to address property tax relief, beginning to address pension debt, as we move forward and those finances stabilize, more money will open up under the budget and we'll be able to do more towards that. And he's created escalations as far as the property tax debt. His proposal for dealing with, the pension debt is to add additional money. And that money grows year after year after year. So it's a way of adding more resources to address the problem. But you've got to get through this. And again, even the administration, and when they first took over, they thought this was going to be a $2 billion budget deficit. It's 3.2. Well, that takes more than a billion dollars out of the equation for addressing these things. So he's doing what he can now, but putting us on a path to do more later.
Not part of this, but certainly being expected, is a capital plan, a infrastructure proposal. And despite a lot of talk along the sides, I mean, I still think there's a recognition that gas tax is a likely primary source or partial source of funding here. And we've seen neighboring states, most notably Indiana, raising their gas tax in an effort to, frankly, it was to take advantage of federal funding that we have not seen the federal infrastructure proposal. But nevertheless, there's going to have to be a whole infrastructure package, a huge infrastructure package. That's going to cost some money, too.
Yeah, infrastructure is huge. Infrastructure is people, they identify with the debt that they can see in numbers, like a pension debt. They can talk about that $134 billion of unfunded liability. But infrastructure, deferred infrastructure maintenance and repair, is maybe the biggest debt we have in this state. We saw right to my right here,
looking Lake out Shore the window, Drive
almost yes. collapse. And this is no joke. Drive under some of these bridges and on these roads. We've seen the potholes since the polar vortex. This is a massive debt that we have if we're not putting money in infrastructure. So it's something that we have to do. Again, we've deferred this so long as a cost-cutting measure. I agree with you. We have to be honest about those sources. Illinois has very low gas taxes compared to most of the rest of the country, and it's something that no one wants to pay any more taxes. I get it, but I think that that's one of those taxes where you can let people know this is going into infrastructure. It's something that you will see tangibly. It's not being wasted.
Capital bill become leverage for votes on a graduated rate income tax?
I can't imagine how it wouldn't. I think it ought to. You know, I mean, everyone's going to have their hand out when we do a capital bill, and of course we have to prioritize our projects, what's needed the most. But you know, you have a lot of downstate Republican districts that they receive twice as much as they put into the pot in terms of tax revenue, and now they'll be asking for even more, but that they don't want to pay anything, you know. So
or want Chicago to secede from
That's that's silliness that comes up for people who are uninformed, and it's too bad. But hopefully, again, this is about education and educate the voters, and they'll give us the approval to do the right thing.
I want to switch gears here. You gained some recent notoriety, I believe, in the mayoral contest.
I did.
For a proposal to make the Cook County Assessor's Office an appointed position rather than elected position, and you would decide to go visit a Lori Lightfoot press conference, which was widely distributed on the news.
It was.
Why did you decide to do this?
You know, and again, that was mea culpa. It was a mistaken judgment on my part, and I've thought about it a lot. You know,
I bet you have.
I have, and Miss Lightfoot has made sure I don't forget about it, as she tweets me happy birthdays and stuff. So, sometimes there's a disconnect. We in public life have to remember that just because we delve into the policy, that's not always the case. The politics rules the day sometimes. And I heard that she was having a press conference. Someone texted me while I was on my commute down to my law office downtown that she was having a press conference about one of my bills. And I literally thought, I haven't talked to her about it. I should go hear what she has to say. And I sat quietly in the studio or in the press conference, and I waited until the entire press conference was over. Done. The cameras were off. The reporters were packing up their stuff. The cameras were packed in their bags, in fact. And I just quietly announced, hey, if anybody has any questions about this legislation, I filed it and I'll answer. And, you know, things went sideways there. Good for her. You know, it was a political moment for her. It helped get her notoriety. I guess I didn't expect, and that was my mistake, I didn't expect it to go sideways like it did, but it sure did. And the way it was portrayed, what I would just say is I've now learned why she makes $1 million a year as a lawyer, because she saw the situation and she knew that she could make me look bad and make herself look good in the alternative, and she did it. And so, you know, like I said, I give her credit for that politically.
That's Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for getting up this early. I hope you can catch up on that extra hour sometime later today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin, the second hour of your Sunday Spin, as it's 8:10 Central Daylight Time here in Chicago. Interesting debate, and I U.S. Senate committee last week over the issue of vaccination. We're seeing more stories about unvaccinated people creating the potential for stirring diseases and presenting a serious health threat for those with weakened immune systems. So there's been talk about a federal mandate that students attending schools should be vaccinated. But Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, a doctor, says he thinks such a mandate would be counter to his liberty views.
As we contemplate forcing parents to choose this or that vaccine, I think it's important to remember that force is not consistent with the American story, nor is force consistent with the liberty our forefathers sought when they came to America. I don't think you have to have one or the other, though. I'm not here to say don't vaccinate your kids. If this hearing is for persuasion, I'm all for the persuasion. I vaccinated myself. I vaccinated my kids. For myself and my children, I believe that the benefits of vaccines greatly outweigh the risks. But I still do not favor giving up on liberty for a false sense of security.
Now, that prompted Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, a physician, to challenge Paul's definition of liberty. Here is Cassidy responding to his Republican colleague.
Now, if you're such a believer in liberty that you do not wish to be vaccinated, then there should be a consequence, and that is that you cannot infect other people. Mr. Boyle, if your child is born with immunodeficiency and someone comes to your school who is not vaccinated, and the lack of herd immunity means that your child, who no fault of their own, cannot be immune, is it a victimless crime that somebody doesn't get vaccinated and your child dies?
A very interesting debate in Washington, D.C., and one with some real consequences as we see more and more stories about it. Well, we're going to switch gears and head back into more discussion of Governor J.B. Pritzker's proposed graduated rate income tax increase. You heard from supporter Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick in the last segment of the show. And now we're speaking to Greg Bays. Greg is the retired president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and he's head of a new group called Ideas Illinois, which is lobbying against a graduated rate income tax. Greg, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You heard, I believe, Representative Martwick's comments. Obviously, you heard J.B. Pritzker's comments. You've heard J.B. Pritzker's support of a graduated rate income tax throughout his entire campaign for governor. Now, with the issuance of proposed rates, does that alleviate any of your concerns?
What we really have here, as we have said from the beginning, is going to be a jobs tax on Illinois. And the reason that we say this is that people have to remember how income taxes and where they come from. And it's really a nice, catchy phrase to say 97% of people aren't going to pay anymore. But the reality of it is this is going to cut right at family businesses. It's going to cut right at the people who run small stores, who run manufacturing facilities, because they do their taxes where they come into S-Corps or LLCs. It means that the money made from those businesses transfers to individual lines on the state income tax. So what J.B. Pritzker is really doing here, and it sounds nice, he's got a good way of putting it. The reality is this is a massive jobs tax. And we really can't trust J.B. Pritzker or the other Springfield politicians, the same people who in the last 8 years have raised taxes twice, to really not take this as a blank check. Rick, you and I are old enough to remember there once was another constitutional effort to try to change the Constitution, and indeed was deemed a blank check amendment. This really is sort of the same thing. And if you believe the rates that J.B. Pritzker talked about last week will be what the Springfield folks, Mike Madigan and John Keller, can ultimately implement, then I might have a bridge to sell you to.
Well, and I mean, one of the things is obviously in the absence of a rate proposal, you know, it's easy for you and opponents to fill the vacuum. I mean, that's just political strategy and totally understandable. But, you know, yes, they're the S-Corps and those who pay their business taxes through their individual income. But as Pritzker says, this is a basis for negotiation. Republicans in the House have unanimously said they're not supportive of a graduated rate tax plan, period, end of discussion. In the Senate Republicans have said they need to see guarantees of protecting the middle class, unspecified.
Rick, what I'd like to see, maybe somebody in Springfield for once start talking about maybe here's some places that we can cut. We raised taxes just a few years ago, and we still have $8 billion in backlog of bills to be paid. We still have a pension debt in this state that is beyond belief of what we're going to have to do to try to pay for that someday. I'd like to hear maybe the Springfield politicians start talking about that in line with, well, let's just go get some more money, and oh, let's single out a sector of our state's economy, and we'll tax them, and we'll keep right on doing what we do, and that is driving Illinois' economy into the ground. Rick, no one can argue that we have turned the corner in this state. Just this week, it was talked about that the number of jobs in the United States finally reached where they were pre-recession numbers in 2008. You think that's occurred in Illinois? I can guarantee you it has not.
We're speaking with Greg Bays. He's the head of Ideas Illinois, which is a group opposed to a graduated rate income tax structure in Illinois. Greg is also the retired president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined on the phone by Greg Bays, the head of Ideas Illinois, a group opposed to a graduated rate tax structure in Illinois, income tax structure, as proposed by J.B. Pritzker. And Greg, one thing we haven't talked about is we were talking about the kind of the personal tax component here. There's also a corporate tax component to what Pritzker's proposed.
It is. It will tax it at the upper level. And when you we have something called the corporate personal property replacement tax. It's a vestige left over from the 1970 Constitution change, where corporations have an additional 2.5% tacked on to their rate, and S-Corps have a 1.5%. When you do that, and when you put this at the rate, you put Illinois up around 11% on its corporate rate. We're now in California territory. In fact, it was noted by someone this week that we would have the third highest corporate tax or tax business tax in the nation. And so I guess that's fine. We like to have that designation. But when we read stories day in and day out of decisions being made, the facility up in Belvedere is an example, when they're going to reduce one of the shifts, where did they put the, where they need to do that? They put that in Michigan. Companies make decisions based on a whole host of things. Tax policy is one of them. This is going to continue to drive jobs out of Illinois.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, in this whole discussion, where are the cuts? And where we didn't see it in the Pritzker's budget / state of the state address.
We didn't see cuts. We saw increases. The minimum wage is there. The AFSCME agreement. He's already added $2 billion of spending before he's even made it through the first quarter of his governorship.
But sir, I mean, but we can't get our way out of this on cuts alone.
No, I would agree with that.
So,
but at least we ought to be discussing it. Springfield politicians, as well as those in Washington, just continue to want to spend. You know the difference between Springfield and Washington? They can print money in Washington. In Springfield, all we do is delay payment of bills. We're over $8 billion. And you know what that means? It means every vendor that does business with the state is waiting on payment. That's how they finance their profligate spending that they have.
So where is the fine balance that creates a system that recognizes a need for more revenue, certainly an acknowledged need for cuts and waste and inefficiency, and provides the kind of stable atmosphere that can help grow a business economy?
I tell you what it is not. It is not just starting out with, let's say, let's raise taxes and get more revenue. People need to understand it's about $38 billion, $38.5 billion is the general revenue fund budget of the state of Illinois. Inside of that are all the things that you know, schools, corrections, healthcare issues that need to be there. Is there any discussion and an examination of trying to take the Illinois state budget and look at some of the things that we're doing, and can we do them differently? I think the people of Illinois are perfectly willing to listen to that kind of debate while we're making cuts here. We may well try to a different mixture of how we tax and how we propose things in this state. But we're not hearing any of that discussion. We're hearing the Springfield politicians do what they always do. Let's raise money. That solves our problem, because that's the easiest thing to do. We don't make anybody mad. And, oh, by the way, have we heard one discussion? One bit of discussion this week about what we're really going to do about the pension debt that this state faces. Not one bit of discussion. J.B. Pritzker stays away from it. All he says is that, quote, we have to fully fund our obligations. Well, that means that it is continuing to take a significant chunk of revenue each year to be able to pay that pension debt that we have, I think somewhere close to $9 billion of that $38 billion that I just discussed goes to pay on pensions. And by the way, all local governments, you've got a little mayor's race going on there in Chicago this year, they have the same issue going on of how they're going to fulfill those obligations. And so the people of Chicago are likely to see a tax hike to do that, and the people of Illinois are going to see continued tax hikes unless we aggressively go after those problems.
What do you see as the answer on the pensions?
Well, if we're going to do constitutional amendments, why don't we talk about adding one that we can change? You know, the courts have ruled that we cannot touch any kind of benefit, that once it's given, it's there for life. So your listeners should remember one thing here, 3% on state pensions, that means teachers, that means state employees, that means all the folks working there, get a 3% hike, compound interest, one of the great things that was ever invented in life. And they get that every year on top of what I would say has been a pretty good pension deal struck with state employees to begin with. Now, to all you folks out there that aren't part of the state system, how's your pension doing? What kind of thing? Is there a guarantee on your 401k that there is a 3% hike each year? And, oh, by the way, let me remind your listeners one other thing. We don't tax graduate or retirement income in this state. So the very people who are benefiting, not saying it's wrong or anything of that nature, but the ones that are benefiting won't even be affected by this tax hike. Let me say that again. They will not be affected because there's no state income tax on those pensions. So think about the rest of Illinois is going to be having your taxes raised to take care of a system that none of us who are not part of the state system can enjoy.
You know, also, kind of, you talk about pensions weren't part of this discussion, and in a limited way, I looked at the Pritzker proposal and was supposed to kind of help alleviate concerns about skyrocketing property taxes, and I didn't see much of that.
Nope, zero out there. And that if you ask in the polls that you see taken, Chicagoland residents as well as downstate look at the property tax question as really a top priority. Think about what's happening in Illinois. You have some of the highest property taxes that are anywhere in the country. You have sales taxes where your studios sit today. If you go downstairs and buy something, you will pay the highest sales tax in the country. You have a whole host of local taxes where we've given the opportunity of local governments to add on to. So Illinois has really become a very, quote, taxing state over the last few years because they need the more money, because they're unwilling to say no to the special interests that keep asking for more spending, to say no to continued pay hikes that you cannot pay. I mean, Bruce Rauner had a lot of, quote, right ideas. He's not able to implement any of them. But his arguments is we have to slow the spending rate down or we'll never get anything under control. And you don't see any of that in this debate.
That's Greg Bays, the retired president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. He is the head of Ideas Illinois, which opposes a graduated rate income tax. Greg, thank you as always for joining me this morning.
Nice to be with you, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
8:36 Central Daylight Time, the first Sunday of Central Daylight Time, a harbinger of the spring to come. Temperatures warming later in the week, something to look forward to finally, and maybe we finally turned that corner. Last week, we heard about the increased demands from Democrats now in control of the United States House, looking for documents involving more than 80 individuals and organizations connected to President Donald Trump. The president says that these Democratic demands are what he calls presidential harassment.
Witch hunt continues. The fact is that I guess we got 81 letters. There was no collusion. That was a hoax. There was no anything. And they want to do that instead of getting legislation passed. 81 people or organizations got letters. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace to our country. I'm not surprised that it's happening. Basically, they've started the campaign. So the campaign begins. But the campaign's actually, their campaign's been going on for the last 2.5 years. So it's a shame. And the people understand it. When they look at it, they just say presidential harassment.
Joining me now on the phone is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg and a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, Rick. Good morning.
Long time no talk. Appreciate you joining the show. You just heard the president's comments. Why should people think this just isn't presidential harassment?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I think that whenever Congress conducts any oversight of the president, he calls it harassment. But oversight has been absent for the past 2 years, and I think one of the reasons why we got hired to be the majority in the House, I'm talking about the Democrats, is to conduct that oversight and serve as a check and balance on the president. That being said, we also have to deliver on pocketbook priorities for our constituents. And so, for instance, Oversight Committee, we're working on the issue of skyrocketing prescription drug prices. Next week, I'm chairman of a subcommittee of the Oversight Committee charged with economic and consumer policy. We're going to be investigating the link between talcum powder containing asbestos and cancers that have been caused in women who used it. So we have to walk and chew gum at the same time, Rick, on all these different issues.
Well, you know, obviously, the Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and people tend to forget that. But you, I believe, in a CNN interview, kind of likened what we hear involving the intricacies inside the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, Michael Cohen. Kind of, you likened it, I believe, to like a Sopranos script.
Yeah, I know. I think that, Michael Cohen was just the latest in a long line of witnesses who've come forward to talk about how, unfortunately, the Trump organization and later even in the White House, things were run. And, now, just as an example, Special Counsel Mueller has indicted 34 people or entities, six of whom were close associates of the president. And we just saw Paul Manafort get sentenced to prison, the chairman of the president's campaign, a couple days ago. There's a real problem when, lying and criminality were a part of doing business in the Trump organization and then leading into the transition in the White House. And so we have to get to the bottom of whether, there was any coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And how do we prevent the Russians from interfering in our democracy going forward? And that applies to all of our foreign adversaries, too.
Well, in the Manafort sentencing, the judge in Virginia, sentencing on tax fraud related issues, basically said, well, you know, there was no collusion here, and kind of seemed to have taken a veiled shot at Robert Mueller and his investigation, which the fact of the judge even professing that there was no collusion was something that the president was, you know, waving like a banner.
Well, I just have two observations on that. One is the judge actually did not say that there was no collusion in the entire investigation conducted by Special Counsel Mueller. In that particular proceeding, Paul Manafort was not charged with a conspiracy or collusion crime.
Right.
And so to say that there was no collusion crime committed by Paul Manafort in that particular proceeding is kind of obvious because he wasn't charged with it directly. The second observation I have is that in the related proceeding that's happening in the District of Columbia federal court next week, he's going to be sentenced again. That's a much more serious proceeding, in my opinion, because there we've already learned through a document that was inadvertently filed by the special counsel and released to the public that Paul Manafort actually did meet with a business associate connected with the Russian spy services in a cigar bar of all places in New York City. This meeting is incredibly fascinating for the fact that the Russian connected business associate asked for lifting of sanctions on Russia. And at that same meeting, Paul Manafort passed private polling data to that particular person. And as I said before, you don't have to be some brilliant political scientist to understand that when you pass private polling data to a foreign government, it could potentially be used to help facilitate or coordinate their influence campaign or their meddling in our democracy. So that was one of the clearest examples of possible collusion in all of these proceedings.
Do you find it troubling that the president to this day still maintains that he's taking Vladimir Putin at his word and that Russia didn't interfere in the election?
Well, yes, absolutely. Russia clearly interfered in the election. The entire intelligence community, with one voice, has said that repeatedly. And by the way, that's why the head of the intelligence community, who happens to be a former Republican senator named Dan Coats, is under fire from the president right now. He may be let go precisely because he's been a truth teller on this. And the cozying up to Vladimir Putin, the repeated statements, including in that horrifying press conference last year where he stood next to Vladimir Putin and basically parroted his lines on foreign policy on various issues, really raises the question, you know, what was the connection between the two of them? We know that in 2016, there was something called the Trump Tower Moscow that they were actively negotiating, the Trump Organization and President Trump with Russians, while at the same time he's denying in the Republican primaries as well as in the general election that he had nothing to do with Russia. And so this concealment and these falsehoods really raise a lot of questions.
Well, I think your colleague Mike Quigley has said that to him, that's kind of a chief concern is what really occurred in these negotiations over the proposed Trump Tower Moscow, and to what extent did that provide a way for some co-opting of the alleged co-opting of the Trump campaign.
Well, that's right, and Mike is correct to be concerned. Because remember, Michael Cohen, the reason why in part he's going to prison is because he lied about the negotiations between the Russians and the Trump campaign over this tower. And now we learned in the oversight hearing that he says that the White House knew that he had testified falsely about it. Why all this lying about this particular issue? And why did they decide that they were going to have a official conclusion point that would end before the Iowa caucuses in January 2016, when the negotiations actually went through June, and then Rudy Giuliani says it may have gone all the way to the election? This is a big problem because it you know, there's a political issue, obviously, when the president conceals that and says the opposite to the American people repeatedly all the way up to the election. And then there's potential legal problems, including the fact that there's an allegation that as part of these negotiations, the Trump Organization offered to give a $30 million
penthouse
to Putin, which is obviously in violation of all of our laws with regard to corruption and so forth, and something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So these are the types of questions that come up. Just to put this in larger context, Rick, we know the Russians meddled in our democracy, and any statement to the contrary flies in the face of what the intelligence community says. And then the second part is it's illegal to agree to receive foreign help. Okay, you cannot receive foreign help because that obviously violates all of our campaign finance laws, all of our principles about Americans deciding their elections, not foreign actors. And so if there's any kind of agreement to receive that help or to facilitate or coordinate that help, that is a problem.
We're speaking with Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg, a member of the House Intelligence Committee and the House Oversight Committee. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. 8:49 Central Daylight Time here in Chicago. I'm in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River, and joining me on the phone is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg. We've been talking about some of the oversight and intelligence committee activities that he's been involved in. But I want to switch gears for a moment, if you don't mind, Congressman. And
sure.
I want to talk to you about H.R. 1, the, quote, For the People Act, unquote, which was kind of a big statement that I think Democrats wanted to make, and obviously by virtue of the number, House Resolution 1, a statement about voting rights. And if you could maybe just summarize that a little bit, and let's face it, you know, it's not going anywhere. You pass the House, but that's Mitch McConnell's already put a brick on it.
Yeah, unfortunately so. I think one thing that most people can agree with is that our campaign finance system is really messed up, Rick. And I think one of the reasons why some of the priorities in Washington, D.C. don't match or align with what, you know, folks like my constituents and others feel should be our national priorities is because of the influence of money. And, you know, for instance, everybody knows at this point who's been paying attention that Citizens United unleashed a torrent of unlimited dark money into the system. And that has really hurt Americans. Just as an example, you know, climate change is something that I think the majority of Americans at this point want to deal with. And maybe we disagree about exactly how, but there's been absolutely no action on this issue, in part because the Koch brothers have flooded the system with money to oppose it. Same thing on of combating gun violence. Again, the majority of Americans, for instance, want background checks, universal background checks. And this measure has gone nowhere in previous Congresses because the NRA and others have again flooded the system with money and you know, basically done everything to curtail any movement. So H.R. 1 tries to do a few things, tries to reduce the influence of that big money and bring sunshine and transparency to it. It starts to reward smaller donations or people that are relying on smaller dollar donations as opposed to the bigger ones. It also, for instance, includes my own bill, which passed the House, to encourage students to vote. Students rarely vote in the numbers that they should because oftentimes they go off to college far away from home and don't know the registration requirements in their new locales. And so my bill called the Help Students Vote Act, which was co-sponsored by Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, basically requires that colleges and universities inform their students by email 90 days before the filing deadlines to get them registered, and then has campus vote coordinators to answer questions about it, and then it rewards those higher education institutions that do a good job of all of these activities. So these are the types of provisions were included in H.R. 1. It passed the House. But as you said, I think Mitch McConnell in the Senate doesn't want to take it up, and that's really too bad. I think this is something we should run on for 2020.
Well, you talked about the issue of dark money groups, and you know, I believe this would require the disclosure of names of donors who give more than $10,000 to these dark money groups. And Citizens United, I mean, going back to that decision, which basically ruled that money is speech, decision by the Supreme Court, and it kind of, in many respects, kind of upended a lot of views that, you know, even if you didn't support limits on campaign spending, you could support the immediate disclosure, you know, in exchange, then just disclose, transparency, right. Disclose. And then with Citizens United, and you had kind of this corrupting of the federal tax code that allows these tax-exempt organizations who are supposed to be, largely supposed to be education, or social, correct, or social welfare, and who are playing predominantly a game of politics and political, right, influences. And there's, once again, no requirement of disclosure of who the donors are to these,
yeah,
groups.
Yeah. If we can just drill down on that point for one moment, two issues come up there. One, and you're talking about those types of entities that are actually charitable entities that participate in quote-unquote educational activities on campaigns. What ends up happening is that they very directly get involved in the politics of those campaigns, and those contributions are tax deductible, and they are shrouded in secrecy. Now, the reason why this has also come up, by the way, recently, is that we know that some foreign actors are seeking to influence our campaigns, and they're starting to potentially funnel money into the campaigns through these charitable entities that basically bring dark money to the table. Just as an aside, the Presidential Inaugural Committee is now under a spotlight because, in part, there's a concern that Ukrainian entities, Middle Eastern entities, potentially Russian entities, donated money through sham corporations and others into the Presidential Inaugural Committee, again, to influence public policy here in the United States. So this is all just completely unacceptable to me.
And it only becomes more Byzantine as things continue on. Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Absolutely, Rick. Have a great day.
You too.